Retro.
Go.
Fido.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon, everyone, from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the May 1st, 2010 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, this is going to be a fun show with lots of nostalgia and stories to share as we celebrate 50 years of Delta launch operations, not only here at Cape Canaveral, but also at Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. We've got a duo of guests lined up, perhaps a trio here, if the third gentleman shows up shortly, ready to talk about Delta launch operations in just a few moments. And you can talk to us as well throughout the program. Share your memories of the Delta II, the Delta III, the Delta IV. You can even talk about the Thor if you want. Give us a call at 321-768-1240 from anywhere you are right now. Local AT&T wireless customers can punch in *1240 for a free phone call. And if you're listening live online to us at the web, WMMBAM.com, feel free to send us some email at spacetalking@AOL.com. By the way, this past week, before we get into the Delta operations, the nation did lose what I think of as a modern American folk hero, a true legendary character from our space program, a character that I don't think you could make up if you even tried. Then we're talking about the one and only Pad Fuhrer. Gunter Wendt passed away at his home in Merritt Island this week, and I want to let you know that I am so thankful to have known him and called him a friend. Our hearts go out to his family at their time of grief. And it's a lot of fun things to remember about Gunter, and I'm going to consider one of my highlights of my career to have introduced him last August at the National Space Club Florida Committee's annual Lifetime Achievement Awards. We were able to give Gunter a Lifetime Achievement Award, and I'm glad we did it when we did it, frankly. The Saturday before the awards, before that luncheon, Gunter was my guest here on Space Talk, and he talked about his career and his feelings about the future of our space program. And I want to share just a couple of things with you from that interview. First of all, let's listen to Gunter talking about the early days of the Cape and working with the missile guys.
After we got off the Mercury Redstone program, we were shifting to the Atlas program. Right. And so then we were looking to launch Glenn, but between that and the previous thing, we had three Atlas failures. Mm-hmm. So that was a rather discouraging thing. And as a matter of fact, at one time, John and I went to the local church on the beach where we had a youth camp with young people, and we talked about the first launch and putting a man into space, and not rather very pleasantly, but I directed the scenery to explain that we could lose the man if he bounces off the Earth's atmosphere and stays in space. So I asked the question, if we kill the first astronaut, should we then cancel the whole program? And after a silence of maybe a minute, and one young man spoke up, he says, "No, you don't really have to cancel the program. Just take another guy, you've got seven." So then I mentioned to him, I said, "You know, I wonder what one of the guys would think, because my friend here, John, happens to be one of the seven."
And Gunter talks about how he got to know the astronauts, about how that when things would go wrong, he'd be the only one that really knew what was happening, and he'd get a team together, and they'd go out to dinner that night and talk, and over the years really established a rapport with the astronauts that, again, became part of the legend of Gunter. Gunter's a pad leader and wound up being in the middle of all of it and really considered one of the fellow astronauts. In fact, when he was working for McDonnell Douglas, And Rockwell got the contract for Apollo. The astronauts wanted him so bad that they basically shanghaied him from McDonnell Douglas to work for Rockwell following the Apollo 1 fire. And Gunter turned out to be the man that put every single astronaut into the spacecraft from Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, right on through the Apollo Soyuz test project. In his later life, he spent years then talking about space with anyone who would listen, had some very firm, specific ideas as to about what needs to happen and his concerns about the future. And when ultimately he was getting on toward the end of his life, he was very concerned about the near future and what was about to happen. And in this cut, we're going to hear about his concerns in the immediate future. And this was before the president's budget came out in February. And some of the things he said are very interesting in terms of what has transpired and what the discussion has been since then.
Yes, I think we are looking at the next 5 years as a very tough time to keep space exploration on the mind of the average taxpayer. We have to change our rhetoric from events that are 20 to 30 years in the future to goals that we can produce in the next 5 or 10 years. If you go and talk to high school and college students, they will review what opportunities may be offered in space exploration to determine what studies to select on what path to take to have a secure future. Mm-hmm. You've got to realize they have to select what courses to take because what directions they want to go. And if you are honest about it, a Mars mission, a manned Mars mission, may not be happening in the next 30 years.
Yeah.
Because we have no vehicle. We have to first design space vehicles, and the Mars mission is so complicated. As of today, we don't even know how we could protect human beings from the radiation that they may be exposed to. Plus, when you talk about it, a Mars mission, one mission, a return trip, is 162 days.
Yeah.
We don't even have a vehicle that will accommodate people for that period of time with all their life support and whatever they need. So it is somewhat ironic that people talk about it where they don't have any physical evidence that it possibly is achievable. See, even when we started early in the 50s or late 50s, we had already rockets that we should shoot in space. And things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, we don't even know if we're going to build an Orion spacecraft. What will it do? Will it go to the moon? Well, then it has to be different than it just stays in Earth's orbit. And then we need heavier rockets, you know, what they talk about, the RS-5 or so. But they're not even on the drawing board yet.
Yeah.
So I think When I listen to people, you know, and I'm very interested in the young people, and you hear, and they say, hey, tell me what happened in the next 3 or 5 years. Or where we were falling flat. We never told the people what we have achieved. You know, we need to go out and tell the people, hey, look, this is what we have done. You know, when they issue a booklet about space exploration or how the public benefits, it normally is such a level that you must have a PhD to digest it.
Yeah.
So we have to learn to get the people interested because the taxpayer is the one that will pay for the space program.
Right.
And if they are not interested, we're going to have a heck of a time getting money for future space explorations.
Well, and that says it so clearly right there. And Gunter, he was sharp to the end, and knew what he was talking about. Rest in peace, Gunter. You will be missed. Well, when we return in just a moment, we're going to focus on that half century of Delta launch operations with three steely-eyed missile men, who represent the past, present, and future of this great American workhorse of a rocket. Lyle Holloway, John Nealon, and Mark Dowen will join us shortly. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. 321-768-1240, the number to call to join us today with your questions or comments. Star 1240 for local AT&T wireless customers. And once again, we invite you to send your email to spacetalking@aol.com anytime throughout the program. Well, it was on May 13th, 1960, that the first Delta rocket lifted off from Cape Canaveral's Launch Complex 17 with the Echo 1 communications balloon tucked into the nose cone. And almost, I guess, expectantly for those days, at least as history judges, the second stage of the rocket failed and the launch vehicle was destroyed. But that has turned out to be an exceedingly rare event for this rocket, which during the past 50 years has flown nearly 350 times in countless configurations, racked up a better than 95% success rate. And so reliable is the Delta rocket that every time one is about to launch, my wife looks confidently and says to me, "Deltas don't disappoint." And to help us celebrate all of that, there's some big celebrations next week, which we will talk about momentarily. But here in the studio is Lyle Holloway, formerly of McDonnell Douglas and a Debus Award winner from the National Space Club, the highest honor anyone in Florida can get. Lyle won this in 1991. We have John Nealon, who won a 2003 Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Space Club and was a longtime Delta manager. And a current Delta manager from United Launch Alliance, the director of launch operations from Cape Canaveral, is Mark Dowen. All three gentlemen here in the studio, and we welcome you to Space Talk, guys. Thanks for being here. That's where y'all say, thanks, you bet. Let's hear your voices. Lyle, let's start with you, Lyle, okay? Let's talk about, first of all, what is the deal here? You've got, we'll talk about the specifics of the celebration momentarily, but what's this all about?
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, Jim, in 1960, we had the first Delta launch, May 13th. And now we've had 347 more, so that's 348 at this point in time. And so we're coming up on the 50th anniversary this week, May 13th, 2010. And we've known for a couple of years, we have a Delta Alumni Association in the local area, we've known for a couple of years that we should do something.
Right.
And so as we got closer, we decided, well, what should we do? Well, we talked about a banquet. We were fortunate enough that NASA and the Air Force were willing to help us, and ULA was willing to help us for a bus tour, and then also to have a barbecue, kind of an informal get-together barbecue on that Saturday afternoon before.
So we'll get into those specifics a little bit later. So it sounds like it's going to be a great time. Everyone's coming together. You got a bunch of folks now. Now, John, let's delve into some of the history of the Delta. This started as a Thor intermediate range ballistic missile, and one day someone at NASA said, "Well, we could use this."
Yeah, well, I go long back to the very beginnings of Delta, or Thor Delta, as some people still call it. I was working with the Vanguard project, and as many people know, the upper two stages of Vanguard are the upper two stages of the original Delta. When Vanguard was winding down, many of us who had been absorbed into this new NASA agency in 1958, we kind of wondered, what are we going to do next? And then, as I say, came the good news and the bad news. The good news was that Delta was invented and that we would be the field group for that. And then we could stay in Florida for another couple of years. The bad news was there was an adjective called interim in front of the launch vehicle, which said it's not going to be here forever. So pretty soon the good news came. The bad news turned into good news, and people decided that they weren't going to build this wonderful new follow-on vehicle and that Delta was going to last for another couple of years. My job in Delta was to interface with the range. I was made the requirements and made sure they met our requirements and made sure that we met their requirements. They were in charge of safety and all that sort of thing. And my job on Delta 1 was to be what we call the test control, to be the real-time interface with the range and to get the go-for-launch from them. As you know, the first one didn't work, but we all got together and found out what went wrong and fixed it. And 3 months later, we were able to launch Delta 2 with another version or another model of the same Delta Echo satellite, which was a spectacular success. One of the most important things about it being a success was it was the first of 22 Delta successes in a row. Now, today, 22 in a row doesn't seem all that spectacular, but in the 1960s, you were lucky to get two in a row from the whole business. And that 22 in a row was really something.
What was – you hit on an interesting point. What was tough about it back then? I mean, now we think that the Delta Rock is such a simple vehicle, very clean, very, you know, relatively simple to put together and all that. But back then, you're still trial and error, still hit and miss on certain things?
Well, we were past what I would call trial and error, but we certainly didn't have the high reliability of parts and procedures that we have today. We just hadn't done it that many times.
You know, right.
This was 3 years after Sputnik.
Right.
So the world had only had 3 years of experience, or 2.5 years, actually, of launching Earth satellites, so there was a lot to learn yet.
And a lot of inventing along the way.
Some of that was good, and some of it wasn't so good, too.
It often has been described as an era when if you had a problem, you didn't need a committee, you didn't need a review panel, you could just stick a slab of duct tape on it, and away you go.
Well, that's exaggerated, but it's the idea of it not being as complicated managerially as it is today. I call what some people managed today as management by committee.
Right.
In those days, we did management by experience, and we didn't have to have 3 days of committee meetings.
Now, Lyle, let's talk about the Delta through the years. Now, if you look at that first launch picture, whether it was Delta 1 or Delta 2, but that first configuration, compare it to a Delta 4 Heavy today out at the launch pad, and even comparing it to a biggest version of a Delta 2, this rocket has changed a lot over the years, gone through a lot of different configurations. That's really kind of made it turn out to make it the workhorse of the vehicle, of the fleet. Who come up with all these ideas? It was just a matter of, hey, we can add a booster, we can stretch it, we can, you know, how did that all come about?
Well, it's the reality of the situation, Jim. If Delta didn't grow, Delta would no longer be in business.
Right.
And so you go back to the early days, as John was talking about, you know, the Delta One, it had 12 rockets, and the spacecraft kept growing. Well, Bill Schindler ran it in those days, and he's really the father of Delta. If it wasn't for Bill Schindler, there wouldn't be a Delta today.
Okay.
And he kept going until somewhere in the mid-70s is when Bill left us. And during that period of time, he did such things as actually make arrangements to commercially fund arrangements with satellite providers like Telesat or RCA with their communication satellites to actually contract with Douglas Aircraft to upgrade the rocket.
Mm.
They wanted a bigger rocket, so RCA paid for a Castor 4 development, a larger strap-on solid.
Interesting.
Now, what they did on the contract is they said, for every Castor 4 rocket that you sell, we will get a certain premium back. And so RCA got all the money back. Telesat needed an 8-foot fairing, okay? So Schindler goes to Telesat and says, why don't you talk to Douglas Aircraft and see if they won't give you a 10-foot fairing. I'm sure they can. And so every 8-foot fairing from there on in, Telesat got a little premium, like a surcharge put on the rocket.
Wow.
And that paid for it. So that was the beginning of commercialization, if you will.
And adding these solids onto the bottom, was that a fairly new idea for our launch vehicles at the time?
I don't know of anybody that put solids on a launch vehicle before the Thor did. In fact, I was out of Vandenberg in the days when we had the first TAT. We called it Thrust Augmented Thor.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, now we're talking about the very early 60s, we were launching the old Spy in the Sky satellites. They were Thor Gina. You know, as a matter of a historical point, there have been 716 Thor Heritage rockets launched.
Wow.
Of that, 36 are Thor. That's
right.
Before the Delta IV. We started with a clean piece of paper, really.
Right.
So the Air Force really funded the first three solid thrust augmented Thor. And then a year or two later, in fact, that was my first trip down to the Cape, was to help the Douglas people here at the Cape actually strap on those solids, align them, and help them get that first launch off of the thrust augmented Delta, the TAD, as we called it then.
And I think folks in the community would recognize the Delta rocket if you can't immediately picture it in your head right now, but that telltale point in time when those boosters would come off, certainly in the old days when all nine would come off at the same time, you know, or was it
six and three.
Six and three with the Delta 2. I could swear, though,
actually,
in the earlier
three,
days.
Actually, it's three and three. You go three and then a second later three, and then you burn out the other three.
Okay.
And then
I could swear in the early days, the early Delta stuff, like when there were nine smaller ones, that they all blew off at the same time. It was always six and three.
No, Jim, you forgot.
Wow, wow, that's interesting.
You better check with your wife.
I can swear I see it in my head that, you know, that they that, when they were much smaller, you know, even long before.
No, the interaction of trying to, even when we went to a six solid, we went from a three to a six. Even the interaction of those, we always separated the three at a time because it's symmetrical.
In any case, quite a sight to see all those things come off, and then they would inevitably get fished out by the sailors and the you know, coming up on shore and whatnot and all that.
There's some stories on that, Jim. Just as a side note, you know, this has been many years ago, and I think we've solved that problem. At least I haven't heard anything lately. But these fishermen would get in their nets. They'd get some of the old solids, right? And they'd haul them in. They'd call us. We'd call EOD, explosive ordnance, because there was a live destruct charge in there, right?
Sure.
And everybody have to back away while the EOD came in and removed that and removed the primacord that was there, you know. So that wasn't too unusual. I can remember half a dozen times, but gosh, that's been 15 or 20 years ago. I don't know. Have you ever heard of that, Mark, since you've been around?
It's rarer and rarer these days.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Look, we're going to stop here for a moment. Believe it or not, we're at our bottom of our hour here. 5-minute built-in hold about to take place. We're going to catch up on the latest news, weather, and sports, take care of some business. And then when we return after this break, we will talk more about the Delta launch operations and the history here at the Cape with Lyle Holloway, John Nealon, and Mark Bowman. And we'll have your phone calls and thoughts, too, as we return from this break. Once again, you're listening to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. This is WMMB.
Now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to the second half of Space Talk on WMMB, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Once again, invited to join in the conversation, Delta Launch Operations for the past 50 years is today's topic. 321-768-1240. Star 1240 for your AT&T wireless customers. And give us a shout at spacetalking@AOL.com if you have anything to say by email. And throughout the week, we invite you to stick to the page, WMMBAM.com, where there you can find streaming live audio of the program today and everything going on the station. You can find a podcast of today's program available sometime this weekend and throughout the week. And if you go enter keyword Space Talk, you'll find a show page that talks about what we're doing here and what we've got planned in the future and maybe some links to some books and files and stuff from the past, guests that we call your attention to. And today, again, as we're celebrating 50 years of Delta launch operations here at the Cape and at Vandenberg, we have with us Lyle Holloway, John Nealon, and Mark Dowen, who are here to talk about Delta. And let's continue, Lyle, by talking about the fact that when in 1986, and we lost Challenger, the nation had decided at that point that they were going to launch everything on the shuttle and basically put the unmanned guys out of business. No more Deltas, no more Atlases, no more Titans. We lost Challenger. That policy was seen, obviously, as flawed. We didn't want to put all of our eggs in one basket. And Delta had a chance to fly again. Can you pick it up from there and talk a little bit about how Delta 2 came from all that?
Well, yeah, going back a little bit, you know, in the very early 70s, NASA had an edict as they were developing the shuttle that there would be no more upgrades of the Delta rocket, and I'm sure that was of all the rockets under in the NASA stable. And so with that edict that says no more government funded upgrades, that's where the commercial upgrades that I told you about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so you go back to 1985. At that point in time, we started dismantling and disassembling the production line. It was all put out in the back 40 at Huntington Beach, California. And so basically, the production line was in mothballs. Fortunately, we did develop commercially. Now, this was McDonnell Douglas. Did commercially develop the payload assist module, the PAM, to go out of the shuttle. And when it was designed to be compatible to either launch on a Delta or launch out of the shuttle. Without that decision, without that funds, there wouldn't be another reason why there wouldn't be a Delta today. Because as soon as the Challenger occurred, the Delta rocket was prepared to put that upper stage on the shuttle, called the payload assist module, on a Delta, and off we go. The good side. The bad side was we had no launches in 1985.
Right.
Okay, that was the only year in that 50-year history there wasn't been a Delta launch. Not only that, but our first launch in 86 was a GOES launch right after Challenger, a failure.
Right.
And now here we are, now the Challenger decision made to go back to expendables. So the Air Force started this GPS contract. Now here we were with almost 2 years of no launches. The one launch we had was a failure. The production line was dismantled in mothballs. How are you credible to win a GPS contract? SDIO came along, and they had this Delta 180 program, and it ended up to be a kill. I'm trying to remember the term in space. Two right. rockets going both at orbital speeds.
Right, kinetic kill.
Kinetic kill, thank you. Both of them at orbital, and they did actually, in fact, intersect. A big bang. We saw the pictures on.
Yes.
Yes, everybody saw those in those years.
Yes.
It was a
that launch very clearly.
But it was a very, very exciting program. And here we were on Delta trying to recover from a failure, and we didn't know the failure cause. Okay, the cause wasn't determined until a couple of years later, so mm-hmm. we had to fix everything that could have caused it, and then launch this new program that has a new upper stage. There were two liquid upper stages. Third stage and a second stage, both liquid.
Right.
And launched this thing about 5 months after we lost GOES.
And those were heady times, you know, and by the time you got to that first Delta II in February of 89, I mean, it was a whole new era for the Cape. I mean, things had turned around and we're still benefiting from all that today, every program. I mean, even Elon Musk out here with Falcon 9 is benefiting from the fact that decision was made, and you guys basically saved the day.
Well, you know, it was 87 that we won the contract, and then some 20 months later, we launched the first Delta II,
right.
which was a significant upgrade, by the way. That was also a big upgrade, but that was Air Force funded.
Right.
And that was the first time in the history of Delta, that is the first 27 years of Delta, when Delta was not in a survival mode. All of a sudden, we could see 20 years of launches. Up to that point, it was a handful of launches or a handful of years at the most.
Well, and John, let's talk about these launches because the story isn't just here at the Cape. Tell us quickly about Vandenberg. I know you spent some time out there. Why did we launch Delta from Vandenberg, and what's the story out there?
Well, our best customer, if you want to go back and look at it, was the weather satellite people, the Tyros, which was built by RCA under an NASA contract. And the safe launch from the Cape only went from 30 degrees north latitude to 30 degrees south latitude, which is only about a third of the surface of the Earth. And, of course, any weather man in the world wants to know what's going on in the whole world, not just what's in that tropical band.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, why can't you guys launch us on what we call a polar orbit with an inclination nearly 90 degrees? Well, the only way to do that from the Cape is to overfly some things like Cuba, like the Panama Isthmus, mm-hmm. and go down the west coast of South America. Well, you can imagine what Range Safety thought about that idea. They
right.
They didn't like you to get near to anything. And but we did have this requirement from the user, and one of the ways out was to go build a capability at Vandenberg where you could launch straight south and get this thing without endangering any inhabited areas. Well, of course, you can't just do that overnight. It took a couple of years to do that. And in the meantime, we did manage to agree with the Air Force that we would have a couple of ones that would do this trajectory I told you about, over Cuba, over Panama, and down the west coast of South America. But they kept after us all the time to go do that, and eventually we did build the capability out there. And after we did that, of course, we found there were a bunch of other customers who wanted to go polar, as well as the weather people. And I guess, what, about a third of the launches are from Vandenberg?
No, our biggest customer from Vandenberg, you know, the most significant customer, I think, at Vandenberg, outside of the Spina Sky satellites, were the Landsat satellites,
right.
Earth Resources.
Right,
the Earth Resources people.
That's
yeah.
the big
yeah.
one. You know, we had a number yeah. of other ITOSes and Tyroses that yeah. went out of Vandenberg, you know, some of the Air Force weather satellites.
But
also.
It was whole Earth coverage is what,
right.
what the secret is.
Right.
And many people didn't care. You know, synchronous communication satellites, they want to be over the equator anyway, and there were a lot of them floating around. So there was room for both, and we gave them both.
Yeah. The facility, I've been out to the facility Slick 2 out there. Very similar, but a few differences, but essentially transparent to the Delta team, isn't it? You stack it and fly?
Oh, yeah, the rocket's the same, and most of the checkout hardware is the same. And this is, again, in the Delta 2 days, and I think that's changed significantly, and Mark can even talk to that when the Delta 4, because
sure.
now we're over at Slick 6.
Right, now we're the old
okay.
shuttle pad.
Right.
Yeah.
So Slick 2 had most all the same ground support equipment and the like that checked out the vehicle and tested the vehicle and erected the vehicle, but the launch mount and the flame bucket and all that facility area was entirely different.
One thing that was very different was the weather. The weather at Vandenberg tended to be, on the average, miserable.
Right.
And the rules for launching. At the Cape, you can't launch if you can't see it. Right. Out there, they didn't have that rule.
Because oftentimes you couldn't see it.
You wouldn't have got many off.
Clear the fog, and then you're fine.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you get on top of Trinquillion Peak, you can actually look down on Vandenberg, and it's looks like you walk on it.
Right.
And then you see the rocket.
And then
right
it just pops up. It's so cool. So cool.
Yeah. Well, one other thing, before we get off of that, talking about Vandenberg, by the way, that's where I grew up. That was my first job at Douglas Aircraft to figure out which end the flame came out. That was January of 62.
That's where I met you.
Right. That's where I met John. That was one of the good times. Anyway, Motorola with the Iridium and L'Oreal with Globalstar all came to life with Delta, with a Delta rocket out of Vandenberg. And we launched numerous satellites, all commercial at that point in time.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
It was a big deal, yes.
Well, and so now these commercial opportunities continue. As we talk about the past, we talk about the present and the future. And really, Mark, you've been quiet through the program, but that's okay because now it's your turn. United Launch Alliance is the company now that has a hold of all this stuff. And you're looking at Delta 2. You're flying Delta 4. Talk about this great legacy and what it means for your team and your program today.
Well, again, I came up through the ranks, and I was in the Air Force, and my first assignment in this business was with a Delta II rocket. And so I got to work with Lyle and some of these professionals. And once I retired, I came back down to the Cape and signed back on with the Delta team. But as has been mentioned, there's been tremendous changes over the years of that rocket in Delta II. And now the Delta IV legacy as it begins. You know, there's some similarities and many, many differences in when the company went about to develop a brand new rocket to support the Evolved Expendable Launch Vehicle program.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few of the guidance systems and electronics and such are carries over from Delta II, but we started with a brand new engine. The first stage engine is a LOX hydrogen engine, whereas the Delta II was a RP-1 kerosene based. Our upper stage, again, is a Centaur derivative, and the far cry from the very small Delta II engine, which is flying nitrogen tetroxide and aerosene 50. So we really started a clean slate approach when we built Delta IV up from the ground, the infrastructure, the rocket itself, you know, a lot of money invested to basically come in clean slate. And design a vehicle that could fly anything from on the medium size payloads in the order of 6,000-8,000 pounds up to the large Titan size 30,000 pounds of geo.
So and let me just about 20 seconds left here. Any great traditions left over from the Delta things that you guys still do today with the Delta IV launch?
Well, you know, we still have a wall of fame, so to speak, and every time we have a launch, it's captured, and 340-some-odd pictures later, we're still going.
It's still going strong. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about Delta as we take our final break and return more on the Delta and the 50th anniversary during our final segment on Space Talk, which, again, as you know, brought to you by United Space Alliance. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB, back in just a moment.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240 and star 1240 for AT&T wireless customers. This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Let me come in here and tell you really quick that Brevard Community College will feature a panel discussing space, what's in it for me, on Friday, May 14th at 7 p.m., that's this week, in the Cocoa Campus Planetarium and Observatory. The panel will include Space Florida President Frank DiBello, NASA KSC's Director of Engineering Patrick Simpkins, National Space Policy Expert James Muncy, and me, Jim Banky. The panel will be moderated by Space Florida's Director of Education, Tony Gannon. Afterwards, tour the observatory and watch the stars through telescopes, compliments of the Brevard Astronomical Society. The event is free and open to the public. And for more information about the BCC Space and Astronomy Lecture Series, call 321-433-7653. Well, here with some final words from our trio of gentlemen representing the Delta Launch Program, past, present, and future, Lyle Holloway, John Nealon, and Mark Dowen. And Mark, from United Launch Alliance, Director of Launch Operations for the Cape here, for the Delta program, you've got some Delta 2s left and certainly some plans for Delta 4 and forever and ever, and who knows where that's going to go with all the talk about on the NASA side. What's left for you for Delta 2?
Well, Jim, right now we've got four missions manifested on the books in 2010 and in 2011. We have one launch out of Vandenberg later this year, and then two more next year out of Vandenberg, and one more out of Complex 17, a scientific payload for NASA called GRAIL.
Okay.
And beyond those four, there are five Delta 2s that remain unsold, and we are looking to launch them for any customer off of either coast that wants to come in and buy that. But the product line is basically not active. I've learned in Delta 2 to never say never, but right now that's really all that's on the books right now are the four sold and the five that we're looking to sell.
And GPS now, of course, GPS and Delta 2 have gone hand in hand forever and ever, it seems. Now GPS is going to be a big deal on the Delta 4.
Absolutely. Delta 4 and Atlas 5, we'll be splitting up that manifest between those two rockets. It's been integrated on both. But we've had a long, long history flying GPS. We basically filled that constellation with Delta 2, put up 28 of the GPS 2 Alpha class. We launched 21 of the 2R class. So all of those went up on a Delta 2 rocket. And now on the 20th of May, we're going to put our first of the new version of GPS payloads, 2F, up on a Delta 4, and that's scheduled for the 20th of May.
And as you guys look at what's happening on the NASA side of the river, are you still just kind of thinking about stuff, twiddling your thumbs, making plans, writing on napkins?
Well, there's certainly been plenty of thought and planning and looking at our capability. I think there's going to be a while before things settle down and we really understand which direction we're going. And in the meantime, our main focus is just on our core business and making sure that we're successful in the launches of our satellites one at a time.
When do we see the next Delta IV Heavy again?
The next Delta IV Heavy is going to be out of the West Coast. It's an NRO payload, and it's going to be early 2011.
Have you done a Heavy from West Coast yet?
This will be the first one off of Slick 6.
Oh. Now, this is a huge rocket. This is a scary rocket to me. It looks scary, and when it flies, it looks like something right out of Star Wars, some giant Star Destroyer. You know, it's just an amazing vehicle.
We have been extremely active in modifying Slick 6 to be able to accommodate that heavy vehicle. We launched a couple of mediums out of Vandenberg, but there's a lot more systems that have to go in and a lot more testing, and it's going to be a very, very big deal at California in early 2011.
That's great. Lyle, we're celebrating 50 years of Delta launch operations, and you've got your finger on the pulse of all that, really putting all that together. The plans for next weekend, a lot of folks are coming. Tell us who's coming and where people can find out more of what you're planning.
Well, let me start off saying that we have a website. You know, it's Delta Launch Vehicle Alumni. That's all one word, deltalaunchvehiclealumni.com. You go on that website, it's got a whole story of what we're doing, the press release, the historical Delta data, and who's all coming to the celebration. Now, the celebration will start on Saturday afternoon. That'll be the 15th at Kiwanis Island. There's about 425 people that are going to be showing up there. Then in the morning on Sunday, the 16th, we'll have a bus tour of the Delta facilities, and that's closed. We don't have any more room for anybody there. And that'll go out and view the Delta facilities. In fact, look at a Delta IV Heavy that's horizontal, plus the Delta IV rocket that's on the pad within a week of launch.
That's great.
And then Sunday night we'll have our banquet, which is our grand finale, and our two speakers there will be Mike Griffin. Mm-hmm. Now, when Mike worked for APL, you can kind of say when we knew him when.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Griffin was their lead scientist, if you will, at APL, and he was the one that helped put the Delta IV payload, the Delta 180 payload together, which was a group of sensors. He's going to talk about that. And then we have Dan Collins, who's a COO of ULA, and he'll talk about Delta 2, Delta 4 in history, much of what you've heard from Mark Dowen now. But he has much more to say, of course.
That's great. And how many people are you thinking are coming?
Well, for the banquet, we got 332, I think, was the last count, and it's still growing.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, gentlemen, congratulations for 50 years of Delta Launch Operations. Mark, continued success. It's a great rocket program, a great piece of space history, program I've followed forever and appreciate. And Lyle, you've been a good friend for so many years and taught me so much about rockets and launch operations and, frankly, how to be nice to people. So I appreciate your work. And by the way,
what part did you recall?
We'll talk later. Didn't it just kind of get you angry a little bit when Atlas was named Atlas V and they trumped you by the Delta IV by one number?
No. There was a reason. There was no Atlas II. I mean, they jumped. They went from Atlas I to Atlas III to Atlas V.
Yeah, they jumped.
Because where's a Delta II and a Delta IV that preceded them?
I'm going to make a big deal out of this before I die. Someone's going to grasp onto it. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate it very much. And as we look forward to the next week here, I want to remind you that Shuttle Atlantis is scheduled for launch Friday at 2:19 in the afternoon. It's very much likely the last trip into orbit, the final visit to the International Space Station. We will have complete live launch coverage of as the space shuttle program begins to wind down. Of course, that launch will follow. Following the launch, I'll be heading up to BCC for that panel on space, and we hope that we can see you there and shake your hand and get to know you. Hope we see you there at 7 o'clock at the Cocoa Campus Planetarium and Observatory. Next week on Space Talk, we'll continue to delve into the history files. We're going to talk about the Manned Orbiting Laboratory with some friends who are joining us from the Missile Space and Range Pioneers Organization, of which I am proud to say I am a lifetime member. It's going to be a real interesting program, and it was an interesting program for the Air Force. And, in fact, the Gemini capsule that was involved in that program is on display right here on Florida Space Coast. So stay in touch with us for that next week on Space Talk. And that's it for today. Thank you for listening. Space Talk is sponsored by United Space Alliance as a production of Mylas Solutions. George Medina is the Starship's chief engineer for this week as Aaron's out there getting ready to be a dad again. So good luck, Aaron and the missus. I'm Jim Banky, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Now don't go anywhere. Dan Connery is next as live and local radio continues on a Saturday afternoon right here on WMMB.